This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Humans act upon the natural world in certain ways under the prevailing system of industrial and economic development. As Daybal Deb knows, actions are rooted in beliefs, in perceptions of, among other things, what has value and what does not. There are, asserts the Indian scientist, activist, and author, more than a few problems with how nature is viewed and thus engaged with. In a new book, he both examines those problems and poses some solutions. In his book, Beyond Developmentality, Constructing Inclusive Freedom and Sustainability, Dr. Deb critiques mainstream economic priorities, calls into question many assumptions about the natural world, emphasizes the importance of civic democracy, and describes how traditional indigenous societies have interacted with nature. I recently conducted an extended interview with Daybal Deb on tape for broadcast today. Dr. Deb is chair of the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies in Kolkata, India, and a visiting Fulbright Fellow at UC Berkeley. I began by asking him to spell out the basic features of the mainstream doctrine of development.
Essentially, it's the foundation of the neoclassical economics. The neoclassical economic theory, which has the foundational pillars of basic assumptions, which I find scientifically totally incorrect and vacuous. For example, one is this private profit maximization motive, which propels all human activities. This is one. The second is that everything in nature is substitutable. The third is that monetization is essential, and quantification in terms of money symbolizes your happiness, prosperity, etc. So equation of happiness with riches, and I mean money. So these are the things which has been ingrained in the developmentality of the people. And it has been not only deeply rooted in these minds, but it's also protected and very aggressively promoted by what's called the epistemic community, that is the intelligentsia, the academia, as well as the bureaucracy. So the economics professors, the Nobelists, and of course the corporate world and the bureaucracy of the states, they all promulgate this idea continuously over this 200 years, with the result that people are given to understand that this is the only option available to them. And this is the best option so far available in the universe. And it's a kind of naturalistic fallacy that what is ought to be. So whatever exists, whether it is exploitation, destruction of nature, alienation of humans from nature and from themselves, between themselves, and all this kind of, you know, destruction of everything human in the human world, and the corporate order of things, the hierarchization of value system according to the market imperialism, I would say, this has been given to understand that there is no other alternative.
What do you mean by viewing nature as substitutable?
The economic assumption is that everything is sustainable in economy. So even if some component of nature is destroyed or exhausted, something else could be invented or discovered to fill up the gap. Economists are fond of giving examples of coal and oil. So before coal, there was the whale oil, then coal came, then the coal gas, then the natural oil, one after another. And the presumption that human ingenuity and innovativeness will create some substitute. So the extinction of anything from the earth is of no significance to economy. That's the assumption that goes on.
You write that the mainstream doctrine of development has a reductionist, instrumental view of nature. What does that mean?
First of all, the reductionism is that, you know, it has all the complexities of nature, whether it is nature or society. The complexities can be reducible to certain basic elements, which is actually the methodology which was followed by classical physics from the beginning of the scientific revolution. And because this reductionist approach to physics or physical world was so successful in interpreting the world, especially the physical world, this became the model for the entire epistemic practices in all the schools of thought in science. And economics tried to emulate physics, to adopt this kind of methodology to become worthy of the name of a science. So in order to prove that this is also a scientific exercise, they adopted this technique of reductionism. And in this case, the basic tenets of this, you know, social complexity, economic complexity, etc., was explained by certain basic assumptions like individuals. And these individual humans, the Homo economicus, was defined as an abstract concept of an atomized individual who has no social relevance, and each individual is guided by a basic principle of profit maximization, not just profit making, but it's maximizing profit. And this is the bedrock of the whole economic paradigm. And this kind of reductionism, and also these natural resources are given. So especially the renewable natural resources like sunlight, oxygen, water, biodiversity, these are supposed to be given in nature. This has no value because this can be freely used, exploited. And this was actually supported by the Eurocentric and anthropocentric doctrine of what once Lynn White called a legacy of Judeo-Christian ethic, that everything in the world exists for the service of humans. So nature has, or natural components have, no intrinsic value of itself. They have value only when it's used or exploited by humans. You mentioned the other word, which is instrumental. Instrumental in this case is that everything has a value, which is instrumental value, nothing else. So nothing has an intrinsic value. A tree has no intrinsic value or existence value. It is valuable only as far as and insofar as it is used or usable by humans for any other purposes, economic purposes. If something has no utility, no instrumental value, it can be discarded, it can be destroyed freely, because the existence and the purpose of existence of these natural things are for human betterment, humans' utility. So this is why the mainstream economic paradigm has become so destructive over these centuries of everything that's natural.
Among the other mainstream assumptions about nature is that there is a balance of nature, that and that this balance is disrupted by human activity. Tell us more about those assumptions.
Well, the balance of nature is still found in many textbooks of biology too, but the modern ecological research actually indicates that there is no such kind of stability or equilibrium state of nature. Rather, fluctuation and fluctuations of population size, for example, is natural. What is important for the ecological economics is that it's a balance in a qualitative sense, not in the sense that one species comes in and the other species gets stabilized as an interaction. It's not that. It could change also over time, over geological periods of thousands of years. But the balance in terms of ecological functions within an ecosystem, that balance is definitely upset by the economic actions. But when we say human action, we have to qualify what kind of human action, whether it is the neoclassical economics-driven actions like factory or pollutants, effluents, which is polluting the environment, or radioactivity spilled over, like that kind of thing, or the activities by ancient shifting cultivators or hunter-gatherers who have been hunting and cultivating these lands for centuries and centuries without pushing any species into extinction. We have evidence of different communities, indigenous communities all over the world, on all the inhabited continents of the world, that this human action by indigenous communities who are actually rooted to their natural resource base have in fact enhanced the existence of this ecosystem, and they have facilitated the co-evolution of nature and human community, because these human communities are a part of nature, not opposed to nature, as is assumed by the modern anthropocentric principles, that human is always above nature and separate from nature. And all that human activity is justified because humans are superior to the rest of nature.
That's the voice of Debal Deb. He is chair of the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies in Kolkata, India. And he is a freelance scientist who's done postdoctoral research in human ecology and ecological economics. We're talking about his new book, Beyond Developmentality, Constructing Inclusive Freedom and Sustainability. We have a link to that book on againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. What about the statement, what about the assertion, perhaps the common belief that there exists nature, that there exists ecosystems untouched by humans?
Yes, this has been a very common idea, mainly propelled by the European ethnographers and European travelers. The assumption was that there are some parts of the world where nature is really untouched, untrammeled, the so-called virgin nature. And the people who are living surrounding this virgin nature or depending on this kind of forests or other wild lands are categorically wilder and therefore inferior to so-called civilized people, civilized world. So it was a dichotomy of civilization versus wilderness. And wild land, wilderness, wild people, savage people, barbarian people, these were the categories which were associated on one set of term, and the other one was the civilized world, civilized society, civilized nature in terms of gardens, pastures, orchards, farmlands, agricultural lands, plantations in terms of forests. So these were the signs of civilization. And so the people who actually change nature, change wilderness into or domesticate and make this wilderness harnessable and predictable and in an orderly manner, so-called scientific manner, like rows of plantations of trees or plantations of rice or wheat, these are the civilizational significance. So that dichotomy, the ideological dichotomy between wilderness and civilization made this kind of fantasy of imagining nature which is totally untrammeled by nature. So Amazonian rainforest, for example, or the mangrove ecosystems in the Sundarban area in India, or Africa, Central Africa, the Congo's forests, these are all assumed to be pristine nature, untrammeled by humans. Recent research actually indicates just the opposite. None of these ecosystems are pristine or virgin. They are all results of conscious use, like agroforestry practices over thousands of years by ecosystem people. Like Mayan agroforestry over thousands of years had resulted in what we now call the Brazilian and Amazonian rainforests, pristine rainforests. Similarly, in Africa, there are forests which are actually savanna forests, and European and American scientists, they surmise that this savanna forest is a result of degradation of a rainforest, the pristine rainforest, which was degraded by the local inhabitants, wasteful use of these, and therefore we now find just patches of some vegetation amid this, some grasslands. Recent research, again, from 92 onwards, with a mixture of different techniques of overlays of satellite imageries and paleobotany and all these, now they reveal that it's just exactly the opposite. It's not destruction of the forest which has resulted into the savanna, but it's actually enhancement of a desert-like condition and grasslands by conscious planting and nurturing of trees, which has resulted in the savanna forest that we see today. So it was always the kind of mythological assumption that this pristine nature was existing everywhere, and that was eventually degraded by the uncivilized, savage people because they were unscientific. They had pre-scientific notions of managing nature, so that led to destruction. Today we know that most of these forests, most of the wildlands, including wetlands also, are actually the result of conscious human intervention. by ecosystem people.
Yeah, and in your book, you bring to light some of the mechanisms by which indigenous societies have successfully ensure the long-term conservation of the resources that they depend on. A number of indigenous communities, including in South Asia, have established sacred groves. So this is an example of one of those mechanisms. Tell us about sacred groves.
This is a very fascinating subject. Sacred groves once were actually abundantly found on all continents, excepting Antarctica, even in Europe. In fact, Fraser, in his famous book, The Golden Bough, has actually documented thousands of such sacred groves in Europe. And in fact, there are still remnants of the sacred groves in Europe, which are now protected as sanctuaries and national parks. On this North American continent, for example, even in this USA, there still are many sacred sites. Even in Berkeley and Oakland, there were some sacred groves of Native American people. And most of these have been destroyed. 2 years back, I was told by these Native American people here in California that in Berkeley, there used to be about a 5 square kilometer area of a huge sacred grove, an ancient one, which was pulled down to erect a shopping mall complex. The point is that these sacred groves, sacred ponds, and sacred landscapes were abundantly found on all continents, and they existed because everywhere, the hunter-gatherer, shifting cultivator people on all these continents protected those patches of habitats of wildlife.
So in other words, these areas were declared sacred by the community.
Yes. Those areas were culturally protected. The mechanism was to consecrate them to some kind of deity, some god or goddess or an ancestral spirit. And the rule was that within this sacred grove, nobody was permitted to harvest any living resource, not even a leaf, not even a mosquito to be killed inside the grove. Although outside, everything could be done. So they can chop some of the fuel wood, they could hunt deer, they could harvest mushrooms, whatever, but certainly not within that patch of sacred grove. The ecological interpretation of the ecological functions of the existence of sacred groves is now known to be as a refugium, that these patches actually served as the breeding grounds, very safe breeding grounds of the prey population, like the rabbits or deer or any other, even birds. And that's why whatever the extent of hunting that continues indefinitely for a long time, it didn't matter because there was a constant supply of this population, a fragment of the population supplied from within the sacred grove. That is what is called in ecology as the refugium principle or the refugium theory, which actually says that if you maintain a refugium of protecting the prey base from the predators in one patch within the entire habitat, then you will never push this population to extinction. There will always be a supply of this population, a remnant fraction of the population indefinitely. This is exactly what they do.
Debal Deb joins me in studio. He is a freelance scientist, a biologist, currently a visiting Fulbright Fellow at the Energy and Resources Group at UC Berkeley, and he is author of the new book, Beyond Developmentality, Constructing Inclusive Freedom and Sustainability. My name is C.S. Song. Debal, what do sacred groves and ponds, what do they have to do with the concept and the phenomenon of the commons?
The sacred groves have existed over millennia. In India, for example, the oldest sacred grove was aged at 5,000 years, that is, since the Indus Valley civilization. And also on this North American continent, there are many, many sacred groves which actually are as old as about 5,000 years. The mythologies of these people say that they were there as long as those tribes actually arrived on that location. The sacred groves actually function as the supply for the prey population, for the hunter-gatherers, or different kinds of crops and the wild relatives of crops, for example, for this population to cultivate. For example, one of the very important wild relative of rice, cultivated rice, Oryza nivara, was discovered from a sacred grove in India. which actually imparts many genetic curiosities like disease resistance genes, which was later incorporated into modern cultivars of rice. So that population is still surviving in only some patches of sacred groves, not elsewhere. Now, the reason that these sacred groves have survived over millennia, thousands and thousands of years, is because they were not maintained by any kind of policing, by any authority. It was actually a social protection, a cultural protection by the entire community. And this is an evidence of how community protection, an active care for nature by the entire community, that is by every member of the community who agrees to the rules of this kind of protection, works. So this is one example how the communities are or can be the best protectors of natural resources on which they depend for survival and subsistence. Whenever these sacred groves are managed by an external authority who have no stake, no direct stake for survival or subsistence on the resources locally, like the state, an abstract state authority, like a forest department or a bureaucratic apparatus, which induces some kind of laws or regulations, then it is doomed. Over these about 50 years or so, we are witnessing in India and Sri Lanka and in many other countries in Africa too, whenever the state takes over this protection, it induces many kinds of violation of the law. In fact, in India, there is a proverb that laws are written only to violate it, only to allow people to violate it. And law is there only to break it, and therefore lawbreakers are to be punished, and then the police comes and the legal machinery comes, the judiciary comes. But in these indigenous societies, none of these were necessary at all. There was no legal rules or regulations, no laws, but everybody followed this. Everybody still follows it because it is ingrained in the culture. Nobody thinks of violating it in the first place, even if there is no sanctions against it. I mean, there are some kind of threats, like the god or the goddess may be angry. But apart from that, there's hardly any kind of, you know, tangible mechanism of deterring the individuals from destruction. But nobody does it. Recently, I have visited the Menominee country in Wisconsin, and they have huge forest land, parts of which are also sacred, which nobody should destroy. And there is absolutely no laws or regulations, but everybody follows this kind of, you know, cultural norm of protecting it. They have an ingrained feeling for these to the extent that they are traditionally hunter-gatherers. But whenever I was asking them about this hunting and the possibility of over-hunting the deer, for example, they always said, every one of them said, well, the deer, the bear, the birds are our brothers and sisters.
I'm still a bit eager to hear from you what you mean by the commons, which you write about liberally in this book, and what you mean by the true commons, which you distinguish from, I'm guessing, maybe open access resources.
In fact, the sacred groves and the sacred ponds or sacred landscapes are the examples of the true commons, where every member of the community has a stake in it to protect it. And they can harvest the water, for example, from a sacred pond, which is the only source of drinking water of the village. The point is that now they don't allow anybody to over-harvest any of these things, to pollute or destroy this resource for anybody's individual gain, immediate gain. This is the most important criterion of the commons, which is sometimes, you know, confused by economists to be the same category of forest, like, you know, the forest under the protection of the forest department of the state. That's not a commons. In fact, the moment the forest department of the state takes over the forest or any other resources as their property, the state property, which is wrongly defined as common property, then the people get alienated. And there are many occasions in India and in Europe that immediately afterwards, the people actually destroyed the forest. There was incendiarism too, forest fires, deliberate forest fires to destroy it, because they considered this is now a property of the enemy. It's no longer their property.
And in some cases, the state privatizes the forest and hands it over to private interests.
Yes, this is a very recent, new phenomenon. As capitalism advances, the model is that you get less and less of control of the state, and you give more and more power to free economy, free market. That elicits a kind of what I call the market version and market diversion of the concept of sustainability. The argument is that these resources can be best conserved by the private enterprises if they gain some profits. So the assumption is that because it's profitable, the individual is turned to maintain it for an indefinite period. But history shows that over the centuries, just the opposite happens, because the economic push is to maximize the profit in the shortest period of time possible. So as fast as you can, you make profit and you maximize the profit. In other words, you are driven to exhaust the resource as fast as possible in order to make money. So this is exactly opposite to the common property resource by the communities, the local communities, where everyone has the stake, not for immediate profit making. There was no profit at all. But everybody gains it by truncating some individual freedom to use it ad libitum. And this kind of truncated liberty of individuals leads to the liberty of the entire community to use it for indefinite period. And this actually is based on the communitarian ethos of concern for every member of the community, including those yet unborn. When we say members of the community, we tend to think only the existing members, the contemporaneous members. But in the indigenous societies, it actually implies including those yet unborn. And the social norm is based on the non-market hierarchization of values. And therefore, they tend to maximize the use for an indefinite period across generations and over centuries and centuries. That is what distinguishes the commons from the open access resource like a state-owned forest or a privately managed forest.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. My guest is Debal Deb. It's spelled D-E-B-A-L-D-E-B. He is a biologist with a doctorate in ecology from Calcutta University. He founded Vrihi, the only non-governmental indigenous rice gene bank in East India, and Basuda, a demonstration farm where villagers learn techniques of building low-cost housing, biodiverse farming, ecoforestry, alternative energy use, and water harvesting. He's currently a visiting Fulbright Fellow at UC Berkeley, and we are talking about a new book of his, Beyond Developmentality, Constructing Inclusive Freedom and Sustainability, published by EarthScan. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Now, it's not just the various mechanisms of conservation that you like about indigenous societies, mechanisms like sacred groves and ponds, restrictions on hunting, fishing, and gathering, and the like. You also deeply appreciate and highlight in this book civic democracy in these indigenous traditional communities. How does civic democracy work there in a way that's different than the democracy that we are accustomed to in industrialized countries?
The parliamentary democracy, or the types of democracy in all industrialized societies, are a kind of democracy which is used by representatives, individuals who apparently represent all the people, where people themselves have little scope of interfering in the kinds of debates. Not everyone is participating. So the participatory democracy is not existing in any of the industrial societies. But in these indigenous societies, they also have the representatives. But when the representatives argue or debate about anything, that floor is open to every member of the society. Although 3,000 people or 10,000 people cannot be together at any point of time, but it is not barred to anyone. There is no policing. There's no formal regulation of allowing or disallowing the individuals from participating in the discussion. And in these indigenous societies, the civic democracy is that it involves and encourages people to voice their protests, voice their opinions, and they have the right to be heard. It doesn't matter whether he or she seems to be a very extreme minority. It doesn't matter. It's not that majority overrules the minority, which is the case in our parliamentary democracy all the time. But it's the case that the minority is also heard, and if there is a figment of rationality, it is debated, it is discussed, and very often those kind of decisions are also incorporated in the majority's decision as well. This is one. The second is that, you know, the civic, when we call civic democracy, it's a result of evolution of all individual interests getting together. So people gather and they discuss on some common problem which they all face together. All of them seek an answer. And this actually motivates this kind of civic forums, small civic forums, which is in the process in all the societies, including in Berkeley, for example. We have civic forums, we have discussions and little groups of people who discuss on different issues, I mean, ranging from the global warming to the Berkeley city management problems. These kind of civic forums usually do not lead to a particular participatory democracy in these cases, because they end up in a kind of representative in the parliament. Not all the people can go over there, and if the representative cannot represent the majority of the opinions, it is not accepted in the first place. They don't have an occasion to be discussed at length and at large. So this is the basic contrast that we find. And the other thing is that the civic democracy is also based on intergenerational rights. So it's not just the right of some people of the contemporary age, but also of the younger people, the people who do not necessarily belong to that particular group of interest, but also those things, and the people of the coming generations, next generations. This is the bedrock of the civic democracy, which is constantly being practiced in indigenous societies. And a very good example that I could cite in this Menominee case, the Menominee country in Wisconsin, is that on every meeting, the representatives, the 9 representatives of the Menominee who function to operate the Menominee enterprise for forest management, they are constantly told by the people, all the other members of the society, that you are not representing the Menominee people. You are not only representing the humans alone, you are also representing those who cannot speak, those who cannot move, and those who move on 4 legs, and those who have wings. So you have to be accountable for all your decisions to those people too. So they consider the trees, the birds, the beasts of the forest to be included in their decision, so that every decision has to be beneficial in the long run to all of these, not just the humans, not just Menominee tribe. And the other thing, I mean, the second point that they always make is that you must remember that if you take any bad decision which proves to be wrong or harmful to the people or to the forest, you will be held responsible and accountable to the people who are not yet born.
Let me ask you about socialism, another way of thinking that I know is dear to your heart. How does your discussion of sustainability and your critique of mainstream economics, how does that resonate with the ideas of Karl Marx and with socialist ideas more generally?
I'm an avid reader of Marx indeed, but I refuse to call myself a Marxist. I'd rather say Marxian. And there I, in the book, actually distinguish these two terms, because the Marxists, the operating Marxists who are actually promoting Marxism in the practical political level, we find that there are many departures from what Marx originally meant. And those are the concerns of Marx, the originally meant in his own writings and speeches, are what I call Marxian theory. For example, in the 3rd volume of Capital, Marx wrote, it's a very significant one which has been recently abundantly quoted by eco-socialists, is that this world does not belong to an individual, does not belong to any group of people, doesn't belong to even a nation. It belongs to the future generations of humanity, all humanity. And therefore, it is our duty to maintain this world in its intact form and, if possible, in a better form, to bequeath it to the next generations. So we are actually the keepers of the world, not possessors, not owners. This is exactly what is a reflection of a Native American chief who once said in the Wampung Bell Treaty, which is very famous in America. And in this treaty, this chief of Wampum says that the world is not owned by I, not owned by we, not owned by you. It is owned by the rising faces of the sun, rising faces of the earth, who are yet unborn. Which implies that no such ecological destruction is to be allowed in the name of development, because we have to keep it intact. But unfortunately, in the major writings of Marx, he also invites technological development. He also wants a promotion of unbounded production potentials. He also espouses, he also greets the clearing of thousands and thousands of hectares of forests for cultivation. And he rejoices in that the freeing of this potential of production in the American continents when the Europeans first settled in this one. So clearance of these forests, the wild lands again. These wild lands were created and freed from unproductive condition to highly productive condition. So this is, I think, this is limitation of Marxism in failing to understand that this production potential is attached only to the industrial production and agricultural production, which is again instrumental value of nature. It actually fails to recognize the production potential of a forest itself. So that is ecological concept. So we cannot blame Marx for not saying some of the things which we do today or understand today, because he was also the son of his time. But he has also transcended some of the limitations of his day. He has critiqued the method of exploitation of nature. He identified the alienation of nature from man, from humans, by the process of the economic development and so on. What brings this ecological economics to Marxism is the critique of development, which leads to the alienation of humans from other humans, and exploitation of humans by humans, and alienation of humans from nature, from the rest of nature, actually. So this is the very tenet of ecological economics, which also says that it has to transcend the limitation of anthropocentrism. Humans is not the center of the world. Everything cannot be justified only in terms of human benefits and human short-term gains of the current population or current generation. It has to include the ecocentric principle or biocentric principle, which is ingrained in many of the indigenous societies. So there it connects the main tenet of Marxian critique of capitalist growth economy to the alternative of alternative economy, which is centered on the ecological ethic.
And in the global South, we don't have much time left, but in the global South, do you see any evidence of green movements, of ecological movements coming together with socialist movements to form effective green-red alliances?
In fact, there has been some red-green alliances and red-green theorization by many authors, including John Bellamy Foster, for example, who has written much about this Marxian tenets of ecological principles. But I don't find any kind of combination of the radical Marxian politics with radical green politics. I understand that the red politics, especially with the Marxists who hold in power, whether it is in West Bengal, where the Communist Party is in power for 35 years in the past, or in other countries, with the possible exception of Cuba, for example. Cuba is a different one, which merits a separate discussion altogether. But I'm talking of the industrial countries where the Marxist parties may be in power for a short while or for a long time. There, the developmentality is very, very well entrenched in those Marxist minds, because the very simple equation that they follow is that unless you develop the society in the capitalist line and the exploitation is very severe, you cannot create a proletarian force. So for the creation of proletarianism, you need capitalist development. And therefore, in order to create this proletarian force, you invite capitalism, including multinational investments in this one, where capitalism is very weak or doesn't exist. So they simply ignore the possibility of pre-capitalist developments or even non-capitalist societies, which are still in existence in different parts of the world, could be developed in a different manner from the one that has been followed by Western Europe 200 years back. So it's another kind of historical reductionism, another kind of linear interpretation of history, that every society under the sun should be following the same linear development from barbarism to slave society to feudalism to capitalism to socialism and so on.
Debal Deb is our guest in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He is a chair of the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies in Kolkata, India. And we are talking about his book, Beyond Developmentality, Constructing Inclusive Freedom and Sustainability. So if capitalist free market economic thinking and practice does not interest you, if you find it unsustainable, unfriendly to the environment and to conservation and to democracy, then what are you proposing as an alternative?
My proposal is not very new. I propose three tenets of the alternative society or alternative economy. One, of course, is zero growth economy, which is essentially that there will be zero big industry, zero rate of interest, and zero rate of profit. The main argument is that unless we have this kind of zero rate of profit and zero rate of interest or depreciation, we cannot have this kind of zero growth economy. And without the zero growth economy, the qualitative growth, not quantitative, but qualitative growth, the real development or progress of humanity is possible. Now, this actually is the basic tenet of the eco-socialist ethic that I am trying to promote. In this case, this eco-socialist environmentalism is an heir to French rationalism. We don't abandon rationality or rationalism, but this rejects the degeneration of reason into economic rationality. Economic rationality is something which is absolutely degenerate, and it's a misnomer to call it rationality because it only defines as profit maximization. So it acknowledges the primacy of homo politicus over homo economicus. Homo politicus is that it actually gives credence to the social relationships and social accountability of individuals across generations rather than profit maximization of an individual at the shortest time possible. And this eco-socialist tenet that I am branding is closest to the official socialism in its critique of private profits and demands for generational social justice. The social justice issue is a very strong one in the socialistic literature, so we absorb that too. But it is more radical than the official socialism in its advocacy of the zero rates of profit and interest and zero growth, because no socialist country anywhere is actually trying to emulate that kind of principle. It's another kind of state capitalism in the case of Soviet Union that used to be, and in China too. Now it is more and more inviting capitalism in its tenets. But we are actually promoting zero rate of growth too, in the sense that it cannot be zero at one point of time. It may be fluctuating towards zero. So the result is that when we have this mean growth tenet as zero, the consequence will be that there will be no mega centralized production machinery at all. I don't say that there will be nothing to be produced. What were we doing 300 years before this capitalism came to be? We produced all foods. We used to manufacture all the goods that we needed, including the clothes, without any factories. any big factories, I mean. So the cottage industries, for example, the home industries, the very small scale community industries, those can persist. But because those will not add to the GNP growth, and because GNP growth is assumed to be the only criterion of quantitative growth in economy, we actually reject that and repudiate that. So in this kind of repudiation, we reject any kind of centralization of production, means of production. And therefore, by this token, it also stops the process of alienation of the producers from the process of production and the results of production altogether. This is what Marx also imagined to be the case in communism, when the producer is not estranged from the means of production and the products themselves, products of their labor, on which they have no control in capitalist economy.
The worker is not alienated from the tools and the equipment and the factory and what he or she uses to produce what he or she is producing.
Yes, I mean, the factory worker does not know the part or the fragment of a machinery that he is producing would be used in what kind of thing. Only the engineer knows it. And then the engineer doesn't have any idea about their final product, when, where it will be sold, and what would be the final price, and what would be the demand.
And we'll have to leave it right there. Debal Deb is a freelance scientist with a background in human ecology and ecological economics, currently a visiting Fulbright Fellow at the Energy and Resources Group at UC Berkeley, although he'll be leaving in early January, chair of the Center for Interdisciplinary Studies in Kolkata, India, and author of Beyond Developmentality, which is published by EarthScan. And you can find a link to that ideas-rich book on our website, againstthegrain.org. Debal is spelled D-E-B-A-L. His last name is Deb, D-E-B. We thank you very much for joining us today. And Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Check us out online at againstthegrain.org. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. Thanks to Mary Bishop, who is at the controls today. And thanks.